Right, so we're talking today about doing surveys during the pandemic, and the three of us here. So we'll start by introducing ourselves. So my name is Tim Hansen. I'm a senior research fellow working on the European Social Survey. I started there in late 2019. So I had about 4 months working on the study before the pandemic hit. So most of my time has been during the pandemic. Before that, I spent about 15 years working for Kantar in the private sector in the UK, but still kind of on social research all of that time. But yeah, at ESS since the end of 2019. So Daphne, I think you'll introduce yourself next.
So I'm Daphne Arendt, and I work at Eurofound, where I coordinate the survey management and development program. I've been doing that since 2017, and I've been at Eurofound since 2013, so almost 8 years now, or more than 8 years. Time goes so fast. And yes, I mainly work on the European Quality of Life Survey, but today I'll be talking about our other surveys as well. Over to Tim. Tom.
Tom, yeah, you're going to have a confusing day, the
Oh
Tim
my
and Tom.
gosh.
Making it nice and easy for us. Yeah, so I'm Tom Emery. I'm the Deputy Director of ODYSSEY, which is the National Infrastructure for Social Science in the Netherlands, where we do lots of different things, running from social surveys through to administrative data access and everything in between. But when the pandemic struck, I was the Deputy Director of the Generations and Gender Survey, or Generations and Gender Programme, which runs the Generations and Gender Survey, which is a cross-national survey on family relations. So yeah, I switched roles as the pandemic was ongoing.
Great. Should say apologies for any background noise with children screaming. I've got a
The
couple here, so we might pick
full
that up
pandemic
again.
experience, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. Exactly.
Great. All right. Maybe just before we sort of go into some of the topics, probably just worth saying a bit of a disclaimer up front that the idea is this is an informal chat really between people working across different studies and just sort of sharing our views and experiences. So anything we say is not necessarily sort of official policy or the official views of the studies we work on. It's really just, you know, an informal discussion. So probably just say that before we start. But yeah, I mean, maybe if we start by talking about our response to the pandemic. So on our studies, kind of, you know, what generally have we done in terms of, you know, reacting to it over the last year and a bit. So maybe Daphne, do you want to go first?
Sure. Yes, because in fact, we had the EWCS CAPI, so the face-to-face survey, had just started in the fields in February 2020. And in fact, it then stopped in March. On 20 March, it had to be stopped. And as a response to that, what we've actually done is we restructured the survey and decided to go CATI, so telephone interviewing. So that's been quite a big decision for Eurofound to do that, considering that the EWCS had been fielded 6 times before face to face. And I'm sure we'll talk about that more because, you know, in our planning, we're going to move the surveys online. But we now had a catty sort of episode in between. And yeah, I think those are some of the challenges that we came across. That firstly, how do you change a 45-minute face-to-face interview into a catty survey where we had 20 minutes of interviewing? So I think that's been a huge challenge, and I can talk more about how we did that, how we broke it up into modules. The other thing, so the background of that decision was that we had a contract. So we had a contract with Ipsos, and we wanted to make use of that contract. And we didn't know how long the pandemic was going to last. So the decision to then go to CATI, yeah, was the most logical. but it also, as I said, it meant having to deal with 45 minutes into 20 minutes. So we now have modules. There was also an advantage in the sense that the sample enlarged slightly. So for the cost of doing a face-to-face interview that we had budgeted for, we could do more CATI interviews. So there were some gains and some losses. So the losses are in the fact that not all respondents are now being asked all the questions. So we modularized it where we have the main aim of the EWCS, which is to measure job quality, the condensed sort of OECD job quality indicators asked to everyone. And then we have modules where 2/3 of the respondents are asked the further job quality indices, although not all of them, 6 out of 7. So we're losing already some information. And then half of the respondents are being asked further questions, either about the company or the individual perspective. So long story short, less information from all respondents, but more granularity, so more ability of the questions that we have, of the questions that have been asked, we have more respondents. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
It's quite complex when you think about it.
Yeah, the issue sort of modularizing is, it is a bit complex, isn't it? I think EVS did some testing on it, didn't they, where they sort of had the full thing versus a sort of shorter modularized version. I think they found sort of fairly similar response rates between the two, but it's something we talked about on ESS as well, that if you do kind of switch mode away from face-to-face, maybe you need a shorter survey, but you know, you might not want to drop any of your content. So that's one possible read to it. That's not what we've done actually. But yeah, it is one kind of solution, but as you say, it's a bit complex, isn't it, in deciding, you know, what goes with what and what impact does that have on analysis and these types of things.
No, exactly. And I think maybe to just add, and then we can move to one of your surveys, is that in the end for us, this will be really considered a test on the one hand. So in the future, as I said, we will be transitioning not to CATI but to online. So this is an interesting experiment. And the other thing that we are doing is to re-interview some of the respondents that had left their email addresses and that allowed to be recontacted on the face-to-face survey. Like, I think it's about just over 3,000 respondents that had given permission. They will be contacted online so that we have some trajectory of what happened to their job quality during the pandemic. So that's a slightly separate study and a benefit, let's say, that we got out of this. But so this CATI survey only went into the field now in March 21, because that's the other thing. It took forever, took really long to plan that and to organize it.
Yeah, I think we've had sort of similar experiences where, yeah, you can't, you know, automatically sort of transition or switch to another mode sort of in a month or two. Well, I mean, you can, but not if you want to kind of test things and develop things and make sure it's done to the sort of correct standards. So yeah, we're sort of in a similar position as well. I mean, maybe just while I'm talking, I guess I can talk a bit about sort of ESS's response briefly, which has been, so certainly at the start of March last year, one, I guess, advantage in some ways is that was between rounds. So we weren't in the field at any round at the point the pandemic hit. So we did have a little bit of time to consider things. So round 10 of the survey, which is the current round, was due to start in September 2020. So we had sort of a few months to decide what to do and consulted quite widely at that time. And the decision made initially was that we would continue to strive for face-to-face fieldwork. So on ESS, it's always been random probability face-to-face across every round in every country. So it'd be quite a big thing to depart from that suddenly. So it's decided to do all we can to stick with that, but to give people more time to complete field work. So originally the round was supposed to be finished in the field by early this year, but we then extended the timeline till the end of this year. And countries could start sort of like last autumn, or they could start, you know, this spring or this autumn. So we were a lot more flexible in terms of, you know, when they were doing things. So that was one response. We did also at that point add the option of video interviewing, because it was felt that even if face-to-face fieldwork would sort of broadly be possible, it wouldn't, you know, it wouldn't maybe be as productive in other rounds. There might be some people who are reluctant to do in-person interviews. So we did some testing with video interviews, and that worked quite well. And we've added that as an option. But I think as time's passed, we've realised that, you know, even with the longer timelines, and, you know, now we're halfway through 2021 and don't have many countries in the field even now. We've got a few. Some countries just wouldn't be able to deliver face-to-face fieldwork at all. So we decided last year to develop an alternative self-completion approach. And that would be used by any countries where it was simply not possible to do fieldwork at any time this year, face-to-face. So it's kind of a sort of last resort. So it's kind of messy to have a mix of self-completion and sort of face-to-face interviewing in the same data set. I know there are studies that kind of do that, but on ESS, it's always been very strict. All countries kind of following the same approach. But there are countries where it's just not going to be possible to do it face-to-face. So we're allowing them to take this quite tightly defined self-completion approach, which is a sequential mix of web and paper self-completion. And we've probably got about five or six countries so far that are taking that approach, but there may be maybe more over time. And that's followed, as you said, Daphne, it's a similar thing. So it takes a long time to kind of develop these things. So, you know, developing what the approach will be. We've been through two rounds of testing where we tested kind of a short version and a longer version. And the conclusion is that we're going to use most of the full ESS questionnaire in self-completion. So when we tested the full thing, which is kind of around an hour in length, it got a reasonable response rate, you know, sort of over 30%, 30, 35% response rate, not quite what we'd normally get in face-to-face surveys, but not so bad that we thought this isn't feasible at all. We thought as a sort of emergency strategy, it's kind of okay. And the sample also looked okay. The data quality mostly looked okay. Although the paper is more problematic in terms of people missing questions and so on. So that's kind of where we are. I think one thing we didn't have was sort of an option to kind of go back to people. So this again is, we'll come to sort of the future later on, but we were sort of between rounds and it's a cross-sectional face-to-face survey, which is kind of in a way the worst type of survey you could probably have in this context, where, you know, it's not sort of a longitudinal design where you can say, well, actually, we'll kind of switch to a different mode and we've already got their contact details. And it's all face-to-face and it's cross-national, so you want consistency between countries. So yeah, it left us in quite a challenging position. But yeah, I think, you know, hopefully by the end of this year, we will have data for 30 plus countries. Hopefully most of it still face-to-face, but with a small number doing self-completion.
Can I just ask, those countries that did self-completion, was there a pattern or was it a mixed type of reason why they decided to go for self-completion?
I wouldn't say there's any kind of theme there it's not necessarily all countries that have the tightest restrictions or that have the highest infection rates or anything like that. I think a lot of it is based on their kind of usual survey climate. So there are countries that basically the only agencies in the country are not doing any face-to-face fieldwork for the rest of the year, or can't guarantee that they're doing it. So, you know, maybe some of them could wait until September or in the hope that would happen. But I think at this point, if they can't be confident of doing it face-to-face by the end of this year, we allow them to switch over. But generally, that is the reason. It's about, you know, not being able to or not being confident of doing it face-to-face this year. But it's kind of a mix of countries. Not all kind of like all Scandinavian countries or kind of all from a certain part of Europe or anything. It's kind of, you know, certainly geographically, it's quite spread. Cool.
So should I? I can give a bit of context on where I was when the pandemic struck, I guess. So we were quite lucky listening to you. I think we were quite lucky in the GGP when I was working with. We'd just come off the back, literally the end of 2019, of spending 3 years of trying to adapt to a life online. The pressures that everyone's feeling during the pandemic, we've been feeling for a few years, I think, in terms of, so for financing reasons, I guess, face-to-face was becoming prohibitively expensive. And particularly because of the type of questionnaire that the GGS is, a lot of it could be done quite well, self-completion, about life histories, and also about things like, they don't like talking with an interviewer about like sexual histories and stuff like this. So it our feeling was it would work quite well in an online environment. Also, we took the decision several years ago to focus on a younger population, which has always been one of the issues with the push online, and is now even, especially in the pandemic, of how you capture those people who are, you know, 60, 70, 80 years old, who are less inclined to kind of fill out a web survey, or even if you do those with Catty or paper versions, then you have mode effects and these kind of things. So the age range limiting to 59 now in the GGS was, it really kind of helped think about accelerating the push online. So we've been doing a lot of work, all the work you've just been talking about in terms of, you know, condensing the questionnaire, those difficult questions about modularization and adapting the structure and things for a life online. We'd actually just been through roughly. But there were still quite a lot of countries who were really interested in face-to-face data collection. But I think that did shift quite a bit once the pandemic hit, because it just became an unrealistic option in a lot of ways. But when it actually it struck, we were doing face-to-face data collection in Moldova, actually. And that really, really, really made field work quite difficult. And we were only able to start collecting data again face-to-face in the summer under very different strict fieldwork conditions. But then you even had this question, if you look at the data, there are almost mode effects between the types of fieldwork. So the moment you have your interview is now done at 1.5 meters, it increases the likelihood that someone else is present, changes how you talk about housework and all these kind of things, which we're really interested in. So you start seeing mode effects even from face-to-face to face-to-face. So that was tricky, right? but for us, actually, it turned out nice, because it did provide somewhat of a natural experiment in terms of seeing the impact of the pandemic there. I think even since I've left the GGP, I've still been involved sporadically with parts of the fieldwork, and there is an acceleration in the take-up of the online data collection. It does seem to have accelerated pre-existing trends. I think you mentioned with the fieldwork agencies, and this is something I see in my current work as well, that there is a real kind of changing landscape of the fieldwork agencies and what they're willing to do, how much they're actually going to charge for it, and these kind of things, which is kind of understandable in this new climate. The other thing that I was involved with at the time as well, though, which was really exciting. So when the pandemic struck, the day the lockdown hit in the Netherlands, we're associated with the LIST panel in the Netherlands, which is an online panel of around 6,000 Dutch households. This has been running for over 10 years now. And we were able to rapidly release an open call to researchers who could submit, you know, get 15 minutes question time within the next, I think it was 4 weeks. We guaranteed them time on the panel. And that led to some really interesting insights. So within 6 weeks of the shutdown, we were able to actually put data out, and it was on the national news in the Netherlands, about the impact of lockdown on homeschooling and the distribution of housework at home, which were really kind of pressing policy questions at the time. And it really demonstrated the value of these kind of large scale online panels and the infrastructure that sits behind them. So I think it was quite telling that the speed at which they were able to adapt and kind of get these things out. So yeah, that was quite exciting.
Yeah, that LIST panel, that's really interesting, really impressive. And I think, I mean, there's been no shortage of data, has there, since kind of the start of the pandemic. But what's quite good is that, you know, that's high quality, well-sampled panel and so on. A lot of the data collection is very quick turnaround on kind of access panels. Maybe some people are concerned about quality, but it's great to have something like that on LIST. It's slightly different, but we made a sort of quick decision as well to develop a COVID module for round 10 of ESS. So we've got a 20-question module that appears in the survey. It's optional for countries, so they don't need to include it, but I think most of them are including it. And that was, again, done with, you know, a quick turnaround call. So we've got two external teams that have got kind of mini modules on there, plus we agreed 10 items with our national coordinators as well. I mean, slightly different to list because the data will kind of come out, you know, probably late next year. So it's not kind of giving people very kind of immediate feedback in terms of the pandemic. But the idea is that it's we focus more on things that will be kind of longer term concerns in a way. So hopefully by that point, you know, it will actually be quite interesting. People will be really interested to look back on the whole period and see, you know, how do people view things? What impact has it had? How does it impact on their kind of trust in government, all these different things, views on kind of conspiracy thinking. And so yeah, all of these topics may be quite interesting and to allow people to analyse them alongside the rest of the huge sort of ESS data set should hopefully be quite beneficial. But that was really interesting because that was, you know, normally our sort of module questionnaire developer for a module lasts 20 months or so. From start to finish, and we kind of did that in a couple of months, which, you know, is for people in kind of commercial research and so on, it's not necessarily a quick turnaround, but for a study like ESS, and we still managed to do some testing, and there's lots of consultation, it was, you know, clearly quite a quick turnaround. So that was a really interesting thing to do.
I think the pandemic has really highlighted how much we need a good European random probability online panel. I mean, if we'd had that, all of us would have made so much use of it. It would have been overused, probably. Yeah. but well, as you know, we did something quite non-orthodox for Eurofound. So we actually went out with a non-prob survey where we did conveniencing, sampling, and snowballing. And in the end got 130,000 responses across three rounds of surveys. And it's been a huge success in terms of media attention, in terms of need for data, in terms of Eurofound being able to tell a story during the pandemic. So from one side, it's been super. And you know, it started very sort of spontaneously that we thought, oh my God, we have so many good EQLS questions, mostly, also some EWCS and some EUSILP, but mostly our standard EQLS questions that we would love to ask. And I must say, we never really thought it out all that well. And it's in a way also the beauty of this period that we let go of some of the strict, slow decision processes. You know, it's we're going to now really carefully look at the quality and of this survey, and we're going to compare it with other random probability panel studies in countries, or we'll probably do some work ourselves in that regard. But it brings up a whole discussion because when we weighted the data, it actually looked quite good. So unweighted, it was very skewed, extremely skewed. But when you weighted it for the information where we can weight, obviously we can't weight on many factors, but for the typical ones, age, gender, level of urbanization and education, it looked good. And what I find interesting, and I did think I thought about whether I would mention it or not, but is that a lot of academics are using our data, a lot. So we get so many requests from across Europe for this data set, and we explain the limitations. So we set them out very clearly, and we say how it was done. But yeah, so it highlights this let's say balance or difficulty we have against the need for data against good quality data. And so again, all I can say is we need a good European panel data.
I think that's a really interesting point, Alex. So I think, because what the thing that I find interesting is when you talk about that trade-off almost between the speed and the quality, whether that actually is a real trade-off. I think where to overcome the trade-off, you just need investments up front in order to address it. So we were lucky in terms of moving online already. So we were able to do a lot of the preparatory work beforehand, but that's, or with the list panel, it was just there, right? So it's that upfront investment. But when you, and in terms of ensuring quality, it has to be there, right? So that when these kind of the demand for sociological data goes through the roof, as it did, that we're actually able there to respond. I found it really, in some ways, a really exciting time to be a social researcher, but at the same time, deeply depressing, because if you look at the equivalent in the medical sciences, the way the virus, they were able to assess the virus, do genetic analysis of the virus, and produce a vaccine by the end of January. And it felt like we're kind of twiddling our thumbs and okay, but it's going to take us a bit of time to process this data and to go through the quality checks, which are absolutely necessary. But we also need to be making the kind of case for investments up front, so it's there when you need it, so that we have these kind of large scale, because we're also lucky compared to the medical sciences, because they have to wait for a pandemic to hit. But the next time it could be a migration crisis. It could be an economic crisis. It could be there are so many different, there is going to be something in the next few years, which we're going to need this for again. So I saw it as a kind of very mixed emotions kind of event in that respect. But I'm not sure that is actually a full trade-off between data quality and timing, maybe.
Yeah. No, I agree. It just highlights the point that you've just made, that we should, maybe the message, the lesson learned is that investment is now needed, and we know why. So we have a case to make why we should. Because the other question that I have, considering that we have a EWCS in the planning that will be testing the transition to online, so we're still going to do full face-to-face, also because we haven't had a proper EWCS, and so the CATI one was a different mode. So do you guys think that it will still be possible to do face-to-face in the future, or do you see this sort of as a catalyst and much more difficult to get contractors to do it face-to-face?
Yeah, I mean, it's something that we consulted our national coordinating teams on this kind of at the start of the pandemic. So, you know, things may have moved on a little bit now. But I think I guess there's not a straightforward answer to that for a cross-national survey, because there's such a range of countries in sort of different situations. So you've got some that say, they've got major concerns about, you know, face-to-face fieldwork even in the next few years. So that some countries were relying on kind of one provider or one or two providers. You know, if those providers decide actually, you know, through the pandemic, we've seen that we can be more effective, we can be more efficient, we can make more money kind of doing switching to online or other modes, then they may not come back to face-to-face. You've got a group of countries like that. But then I would say certainly on ESS, the majority of countries, certainly when we consulted last year, thought that face-to-face would be around for a little while to come and would still be, you know, the best method in that country for something like ESS. We were maybe a little bit surprised. I think in the sort of central team that oversees ESS, perhaps partly where we're based, so a lot of us are in sort of the UK and Germany and Norway and things, we kind of felt maybe the transition to sort of, you know, online-led self-completion would come a bit more quickly. But if you talk to the countries, the sort of national coordinating teams, certainly last year, most of them were kind of more positive about face-to-face. But then sort of comes the challenge of, you know, what do you do? So if you've got one group of countries that say, we need to switch away from face-to-face, you've got another group that say, you know, we should stick with face-to-face. We've always had sort of consistency of methodology between countries until this round. So do we keep that and then have a method that, you know, is kind of not optimal for all the countries, but is consistent, or do you allow allow that variation. And that comes back to something else you said, Daphne, which was about your sort of data users. So you sort of said, you know, so as sort of research methods people, we generally have quite large concerns about things like online access panels. I think, you know, for kind of important population measurement, we probably shouldn't be using them. But actually, you know, if you put the data out there, lots of academics, lots of data users will use it and will like the speed at which it's put out there. So this is something we've discussed a little bit in terms of different modes where, so we're going to have two separate data sets. So we're going to have a data set for those doing the survey face-to-face and a data set for those doing self-completion. And users could merge the data sets, but I think we'll put sort of health warnings about it because for an attitudinal survey like ESS, you get pretty large mode effects with sort of interviewer effects and social desirability and all of these things. But then there's a question of, you know, how important is it for data users? How much do they care if you know, some countries use this mode and some countries have used this mode? And you know, maybe, and how much should we make them aware of that? So it may be they don't care, but it may also be that it's impacting on the analysis they're doing. So they're kind of picking these differences between countries, but actually it's partly explained by, you know, mode and sort of measurement differences. So it's kind of, yeah, questioning what our role is in that as well. But if we are having this kind of mix of approaches between countries, or you're having some approaches that are maybe not the standards that we usually have, what sort of role do we have in informing and kind of educating data users on this and around the sort of limitations? So that's another kind of related question we'd be considering.
Yeah, that's a good point. Very good.
I don't know about, like, it is a very interesting question about what kind of sophistication you can assume of the researchers, right? Especially in terms, but I think we do have to be maybe a bit less paternalistic as data infrastructures, because it's not just the responsibility of the data providers as well, it's the research community. I mean, this goes through peer review, these go through kind of a wider scientific process than just the infrastructures are providing, I guess. Because you could also equally make the same case. I mean, you said consistency of methodology, but there's interviewer effects, there's sampling effects, very different sampling frames used throughout Europe and these kind of things, which have almost as big as, you know, effect on responses as mode effects, right? Yeah. So I think there is a lot of, it needs to be placed in context a little bit, right? Because I have never met anyone, any researcher who's not just studying a methodological issue who controls for interviewer effects in their research.
You know, that's a really good point. And we actually start to question this a little bit more now, I think, that a lot of things you sort of take for granted, don't you? If you think, as I say, we've always been consistent, all countries are consistent. But as you say, you know, comparing countries, they use different sample frames. They've got completely different field forces with different experiences. You know, even within countries, you're changing survey agency quite often from round to round. They've got different practices, different sets of interviewers. And you've got the whole issue of interviewer effects that, I mean, there's this kind of belief maybe that, you know, face-to-face is the gold standard. And in lots of ways it is. You get sort of the best response rates in most countries. You know, you can, in theory, get away with a longer interview because the interviewer is there. If you're collecting sort of detailed education, occupation information, interviewers are generally better at doing these sorts of things. So in those ways, it's kind of gold standard. But if you've got a survey that's full of attitudinal questions, then you might not be getting honest responses with an interviewer there. So I think through this process, we have sort of questioned a little bit more. You know, clearly there's a lot of benefits of face-to-face interviewing, but actually there's some limitations as well. So we shouldn't totally disregard them going forward.
No, and I think the other point is that there's so many elements to quality. So when we were designing this quick survey, we were using our experience from doing a proper survey. So we were looking at the quality of translations. We were making sure that items that we were including were tested items. Those were the kinds of things that we were taking into consideration. So it's not just the sampling methodology that matters. And often that's where all the focus goes, but issues like translation, how you report the results and how you report the process, so making sure everything is documented and accessible to the user is equally important.
Yeah.
So I think maybe that's a lesson that we can learn a little bit, that it's this full picture. So this, you know, what is it, Lars Liebergs, a total survey error story, that you take all the facets of producing a survey into account. And when you then use a non-probabilistic method, then perhaps make sure that you do consider all these other steps, and that where you can, you ensure this high quality. And I mean, just to say that for Eurofound, we will continue our traditional survey program. So we will go back to the high quality surveys. As I said, I'm speaking on my own account. Some of these decisions have to be made, but that's at the moment what it looks like. Nevertheless, we probably will more formally institutionalize this survey for some specific purposes. So as long as we don't have this European random probability panel, we might say, well, we're going to test it in 23 on young people. So we want to see if it can be useful for specific populations. In round three, we included data on people with disabilities. We could have thought of it in round one, but we only thought of it in round three. And there's such a data gap, so much data missing when it comes to people with disabilities. And it was very useful. So we have a rather good sample size of people with disabilities. It's around 7,000 respondents. And we see very big differences between them and the group of people without disabilities. So again, it serves a very useful information gap, filling that gap. I'm very glad that we did that.
But I think that's partly one of the changes that I would actually say that the pandemic has kind of brought about. In the past, if you look even 10 years ago, social surveys were this very generic thought that they were like the main source of data into social research. But then now under pressure from so many different other varieties of data input, and that's just been accelerated by the pandemic. So they're becoming much and much more a specific calibrated tool for specific instances, which is not necessarily a bad thing. But, you know, you have administrative data that's available. You have, in the GGS, we were kind of we were monitoring. There were groups of demographers monitoring the pregnancy intentions by looking on the Google searches for contraceptive usage and things like this. And we were able to see whether that kind of aligns with the survey results. And to be frank, that they were getting quite a lot of, you know, very accurate information on that tracks with fertility patterns. So when that really asks the question of, okay, what are you specifically using the survey for? Why does it need to be face-to-face? In which context? But I do think it means that the types of questions and the types of research that surveys are being addressed to is probably being narrowed quite a bit. And I do think that pressure on it shouldn't necessarily be seen as a bad thing. It's just a way to sharpen its focus. And it doesn't have to be all things to all people then, right?
Yeah,
I agree.
I think, yeah. So I think we're probably sort of coming towards the end. We've kind of touched on the future a bit already, haven't we? So I guess that's sort of the last thing to say. It's obviously we're dealing with a very unusual and kind of emergency situation in the last year and a bit. And the big question is how much of what we've done now stays, and, you know, to what extent do things go back to normal? Probably not entirely, but that's a big debate we're sort of having on ESS at the moment. We've decided this is a really good time to consider what our future should look like. And we're, in fact, next week having a couple of big meetings to start to think about that and different options. You know, ESS has always been this kind of every 2 year, very large scale face-to-face survey. Is that still the best model? Or should that be changed to something maybe, you know, that relies on less frequent, you know, big data collection, allows more sort of flexibility between rounds, or you know, do we still want our sort of hour-long questionnaire? Do we want to cut that down? Do we want to shift the focus of the survey at all? So yeah, these are things that we're all considering. And alongside that, you know, what we're doing in the future in terms of data collection mode. So going back to the discussion we had, is this a time to think, you know, we are going to need to move away from face-to-face, and you know, when are we going to introduce that, and how's that going to work in all the different countries? So we've kind of got a lot of questions at the moment. I wouldn't say as a result of the pandemic we've shifted anything yet, but I think probably over the next few months we'll start to learn a bit more about that. I think one thing I do get the sense we may want to do is think about how can we be a bit more flexible. So kind of even if we have this kind of big vehicle of this kind of, you know, every 2 year big face-to-face survey, or maybe it switches to a different mode at some point, you know, do we have more ways of actually getting to people between rounds, between waves? So, you know, hopefully there won't be another pandemic coming up, but if there's other kind of big events where we want to get some, you know, sort of cross-national quick turnaround data, is there a way we can integrate that into what we're doing with ESS? Again, it comes back to what you mentioned, Daphne, on the kind of, you know, high quality, you know, cross-national panel in Europe. So I know there's been kind of, you know, bids for sort of development work around that maybe haven't been successful yet. So that may be something that comes back in the future. I think the challenge we've got is that we've got this sort of objective to kind of grow ESS as much as possible. And the number of countries has sort of increased round on round. And we want to keep doing that. We want to keep on, you know, bringing in more countries if we can. But will you get to a point where you have a, you know, cross-national random probability panel that covers 30 plus countries? Or if you kind of go down that route, maybe you need to focus on a smaller number of countries and for that side of things, and kind of have different data collection for the other countries. So yeah, they're kind of all some of the questions we're juggling at the moment.
No, I think, I mean, in terms of, so one of the things that I'm taking out of it is that, so 10 years ago, I think that in the social sciences, the ESS and SHARE and the GGP and things were forced to adapt the terminology of infrastructure. And I think it was a bit begrudgingly to say, oh, we're infrastructures. But in reality, oh, we're just surveys, but we'll call ourselves infrastructures in this European context, because that's what we're referred to. And that's how the financing comes down. But I think increasingly it's a label that fits, and we should actually embrace a little bit more, because the ESS is an infrastructure. It is there. It is big. It is, yeah. You know, it is concrete, as it were. And when these kind of things hit, you need the infrastructure in place. It is ready made there to be kind of exploited. And so I think we should kind of lean into that a little bit more, because as well, I think it's the scale of it kind of better illustrates the scale of investment that required in order to deliver what I think the governments and society more generally actually want, which is to be able to kind of see what is going on and actually understand what the hell is happening in society as these kind of events unfold. Because that's been the kind of clear indication for me from the pandemic that when we were able to respond quickly, there was such a huge thirst for it, that we'd be silly not to invest in the ability to speed that up, to ensure quality all the time, but to be able to speak about current issues fairly rapidly.
Yeah, definitely.
Same here, I would say. I mean, one of the things we are hoping to test, and I know you on the ESS, you've done a lot of that already, but because of our survey being quite specific on working conditions, what we would like to see is whether we can at least do some sequential interviewing, so having some sort of a panel test. I'm not sure if we have the funding for it, but this would be great if we would be able to do that, and then think about what you would want to ask in these little follow-up questionnaires, and that could be very much related to the demand or the need for information that arises as you do it. So yeah, I think it's quite exciting times. But you know what I also think is difficult, and I don't know if you've come across that as well. I think your stakeholders are slightly different from ours, but there's that huge desire to keep things as is. So you know, also with trend questions, particularly on an EWCS that goes back to 1990, 91, this fear that you will lose information. And so I think that's something where we're not quite there yet. So on the one hand, you have the users that are very happy when you have fresh data, and at the other end you have the traditional users that are very keen to make sure things are kept as they are in terms of method and in terms of content. So we have quite some challenges ahead of us still.
Yeah, definitely. And that's a thing, something we've talked about a lot is, I mean, we on ESS, we have long, long discussions, and there's kind of lots of people involved. We have the core scientific team that sort of oversees activities. We've got a methods board and scientific advisory board and our national coordinator. So there's lots of discussions, lots of consultation, but I would say the typical decisions that are often made are, you know, let's leave it how it is. So, you know, obviously I'm generalizing a bit there, but I think more often than not, we debate these things, we discuss them, and then think, often, you know, usually for good reasons, because, you know, a lot of work has gone into develop these things and it's, you know, robust and reliable and so on. But yeah, maybe things will need to change a bit in the future. We might need to be a bit kind of more adaptive. We're already seeing now, so when we developed the paper, the self-completion survey on web and on paper, we've generally, you know, because this is kind of an emergency for this round at the moment, we stuck to the questions as much as possible in terms of how they're asked in the face-to-face survey, adapted the wording, adapted the instructions a little bit, but we haven't kind of redesigned the questionnaire and said, how would this work in a self-completion environment? And kind of take it from scratch almost. We'd probably do that maybe more in the future, but for now it's been kind of adapting what we've got. And you kind of see that actually that doesn't necessarily work. So the way you ask about education and occupation works in one way in face-to-face, but with sort of self-completion, it's much more challenging. So we'd need to review things like that a lot more in future. And I think just related to another thing you said, so we've got our Kronos panel, which is kind of, you know, building in that sort of between round ability to be able to compare things more quickly and get some results in some key areas. So that we're doing that in 12 countries after this round of ESS, which would be really interesting to see how that goes. And that kind of comes back to what Tom said about the infrastructure, I guess. So at the moment, that is, there's still quite long lead-in times in a way to actually, you know, select and design the modules. But once you've got the infrastructure for something like that, you can potentially be a lot more flexible in future and collect data more quickly. Sorry, Tom, do you want to come in?
Yeah, no, it's, I'm just going to say it's a Pandora's box there. I've always kind of raised this question, even when the Kronos panel was first introduced. At the moment you start collecting data longitudinally, you'll notice the thing that happens is you get a lot more psychologists and a lot more economists knocking on your door. It starts to change what the ESS is looking at, right? Yeah. And I think that's a real challenge. But yeah, it's more demand, I guess. But it does shift the focus, because they all want to do, you know, see how happiness tracks over month. But yeah, these kind of
yeah, things. And the challenge, I guess, is, I mean, that's great bringing in, you know, new groups of users, isn't it? But maybe not at the expense of your more traditional kind of user base. So, exactly.
I mean, there's nothing wrong with a cross-sectional study like the ESS, right? So you could just move it online. There's not necessarily a need for a panel element, maybe.
Yeah. Well, that's something we're talking about at the moment. Yeah. Great. I think we're pretty much on time or out of time. I don't know, Daphne or Tom, did you have anything else you wanted to add at the moment?
No, I think we covered it quite well.
The only thing is I'm quite depressed that we're now on record. So whatever happens in the next few years, we'll be able to demonstrate just how wrong we were, right?
Yeah. But, you know, if the pandemic's shown one thing, it's shown that uncertainty abounds.
Exactly.
Great. All right. Well, let's wrap it up there. And thanks, everyone. Hopefully people will enjoy this. And feel free to get in touch with us when you're listening if you've got any questions or want any further information.
Thanks
a lot. Perfect.